Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You've heard of good sportsmanship, respecting your opponent even if they hate you. No one was more tested on that score than track great Jesse Owens in 1936 when the Olympics were held in Berlin and the Nazis grudgingly allowed Jews and blacks to participate. In this clip from the opening ceremonies, Owens describes the scene.
The French team gave the Olympic salute. Thousands of Germans in the stand mistook it for the Nazi salute, and they roared their approval.
Jesse Owens, of course, went on to win 4 gold medals during those games, making more of a political statement than any salute could. That intersection of sports and politics occurred on an international scale and is just one of a multitude of examples of how sports drives politics and, conversely, how politics can drive sports. In his new book, Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics, author and law professor Roger Abrams writes about the relationship starting all the way back at the dawn of human society. He joins us now by phone from Boston. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Good.
You made the point in your book that the relationship between sports and politics goes back to the beginning of human society, and it really made me think it went back to the beginning of the schoolyard in my world, who got picked for dodgeball, and everything about hierarchy and power on the playground. It felt like it's part of our DNA.
I think you're right that there's something very human about sports. When humans first descended from the trees and hunted for food on the plains of Africa, they would practice, and their practice turned out to be sports, because having good eye-hand coordination was critical if you were going to bring down dinner. And those sport-like activities took on a very religious significance, because it was a matter of life and death. And so since then, which is for us the beginning of time, it has been an essential part of what it means to be human. There is no one in society who is unaffected by sports. There are some people who don't particularly like sports. I can understand that, although I can't imagine anyone in Columbus not loving the Buckeyes. But in any case, even if you don't like it, it affects what you do. Much the same with politics. You may not like it, but it is part of what you are.
It's easy to look back at ancient Rome and consider how the politicians used sports to woo the voters. I thought that was very interesting in your book, but you point out that very wealthy people did the same thing. And then fast forward 2 millennia to modern Rome, and we have nothing less than the likes of billionaire politician Silvio Berlusconi in a bit of trouble these days, of course. But his use...
Well, that's only... his trouble is always only temporary.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're convicted and you're sentenced. There will be appeals. He has come out of it all the time. But Berlusconi probably still is, one of the richest people in the world.
Right.
He owned everything in Italy, but none of it had any political import until he bought the soccer team in Milan, AC Milan. And then as the owner of the soccer team, he creates his own political party and runs for office and has been prime minister 3 times, at least so far, of that country. He's quite a character.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Roger Abrams. He is the author of a new book. It's called Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. If you have a question or comment for Roger, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or tweet us at WOSU All Sides.
There's that connection between big sports and the popularity and what it does to the masses and what it can do to you as an individual if you bring the big sports to the masses.
And not only that, our politicians love to be associated with the big sports. Our president wears his White Sox warming up jacket and his cap. And the mayor of New York City will wear his Yankees cap. You would think, in order to be bipartisan, he ought to wear a Mets cap every so often.
I love but, your... But, go ahead.
But in any case, they certainly do see the association with sports as having political value, going way back to President Taft, who decided in 1910 at the opening day of a local baseball team that he would bring his entire cabinet out to the baseball park, and so he could throw out the first ball.
Ooh.
Now, Taft was a former first baseman for the Yale Bulldogs, and so he had a sporting background, although by the time he was president, I think he was perhaps too heavy to play sports. But he threw a strike to the pitcher, and the pitcher went out and threw a one-hitter. The rest of the story I'm not sure is true, but it's still a great story. By about, the seventh inning, everyone just needs to get up and kind of walk around and stretch. And Taft got up, and out of respect for our president, the entire crowd got up along with the president, thus creating the seventh inning stretch.
Well, it had to start somewhere there, so that's as likely a story as anything.
I think so. It's good enough to tell in the book.
You tell, it's pretty funny about Richard Nixon giving advice. Yeah. tell us about that, because how weird is that?
Richard Nixon really wanted to be an athlete. He played third string tackle, I think it was, for the Whittier College football team. Whittier College, the first small college, still is a wonderful place. But third string means, oh my goodness, you're terrible. but Nixon credited his experiences on the team for his success in life and in politics, and gave special praise to his coach. Now, his coach, when asked about it, could only remember that Dick Nixon showed up for every practice and seemed to love the smell of sweat. Well, I guess so.
Gross.
In any case, when he was president, he would call up various head coaches of pro football teams, typically call after midnight, saying, "This is the President of the United States, and I have a play that you should use this Sunday." Well, they couldn't refuse. They put in the plays, and the plays were terrible. So too were the Washington Redskins at the time. Nixon was a piece of work.
Do you think a president could get away with that now?
Oh, a president can get away with a lot of things. Bill Clinton used to play golf, and when he didn't like the shot he took, he wouldn't record it as a shot. He would just gain a couple of extra strokes along the way. And of course, about Clinton would go jogging around Washington from one McDonald's to another.
Yes.
In order to make sure that there was uniformity in the quality of French fries. There were some good golfers as president. Eisenhower was a good golfer. Kennedy was a good golfer. And our Barack Obama attempts to use golf as kind of a lubricant to political discussions. So far, his golfing is better than his political discussion.
I thought Jerry Ford was pretty good at golf.
Jerry Ford was the one truly great athlete who became president. He was All-American,
right?
An All-American center at University of Michigan. You're allowed to say University of Michigan on OSU radio.
I'm from Michigan. I'm from Jerry Ford country, so you're okay.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. So Grand Rapids and thereafter, it is perfectly fine. He was offered professional contracts after he graduated to play in the National Football League. He turned it down and then proceeded to with his legislative career. Now, there was Calvin Coolidge, who, while he did not golf, was a fisherman. And he loved to have his picture taken out there in the ponds of Vermont and New Hampshire, bringing in the fish. What he did not know, apparently, is that the Secret Service had gone out earlier and had stocked the ponds with fish. And so Cal was terrific. He'd throw in the fish were just waiting to be caught. Herbert Hoover invented his own sport game, which involved taking a medicine ball and throwing it over a volleyball net. And he would go around the White House and say, "All right, we're going to play." And the president ordered you to go outside. And
by the way, a medicine ball is a heavy ball.
Oh my goodness! It's this huge, huge rock kind of thing.
Right.
It was a silly game, but at least it got him away from the troubles of the day.
And you did refer to Barack Obama's sharp elbow on the basketball court.
Well, you know, this is. I don't cite anything from that for that proposition. I was told that by people who were his classmates at Harvard Law School.
Okay.
And I played in that gymnasium, and those games were as rough as any federal court litigation. he was very good, although, you know, my guess is his game is slipping just a little bit as he gets well into his second term.
He has other worries. You know, sports are so big with presidents, like you just described. It's hard to imagine that most of the founding fathers frowned on such games back in the early history of the United States, or, you know, the colonial history, at least. Games and sports were frowned on. But George Washington was an exception.
That's true. At Valley Forge, he recognized it was important that his troops stay as active as they could. And so he encouraged games of throwing the ball around. It wasn't yet baseball, but it was an athletic activity, and Washington understood its importance. And I think all of us now understand the importance of being involved in some athletic activity, especially as we get rather obese as a nation. It's really important to exercise. On the other hand, apparently we prefer sitting in front of the television
and watching
some young men run into each other.
I want to go back quickly to Jesse Owens, the Jesse Owens
sure.
story in Berlin. You've said that most people don't know what really went on at the 1936 Olympics.
Well, you know, the problem with the 36 Olympics is that they are they're reflected in our history based on the fact that we won the war, which of course was a good thing that we won the war, and the war was only 3 years after began, only 3 years after the Olympics,
right.
And so as victors, we could tell the great stories of Jesse Owens showing how ultimately stupid the whole Aryan superiority concept was. On the other hand, no one ever reports that the German team won more medals than any other team in the world. And in fact, those 36 Olympics were an enormous psychological success for the Nazi Party. It rallied the German people in support of this party. It gave Hitler a little breathing space to rearm his country before launching the war. And people said, look, he could turn off the evils of Nazism just like that. And in fact, he did. For a 2-week period, there were no anti-Jewish signs in all of Berlin. And then everyone left town and everything was put back in place.
Once again, my guest is Roger Abrams. We're talking about his new book, Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. Give us a call if you have a question or comment for Roger, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from K.A. Menendian Rug Gallery in Grandview, offering timeless hand-knotted designs from traditional to contemporary, featuring a full-service rug cleaning and repair department. K.A. Menendian, fine oriental rugs since 1910. More information at karugs.com.
Columbus on the Record brings you in-depth, thoughtful, and balanced analysis of the issues impacting life in Central Ohio. Be sure to watch WOSU News Director Mike Thompson and his panel talk about the top local and national stories of the week. Watch Columbus on the Record Friday nights at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The intersection of sports and politics is as ubiquitous a relationship as you'll find, and it goes back to the beginning of human society and has endured to the present, of course. Still with us, Roger Abrams. He's the author of Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. And I wanted to talk about the role that sports played in post-apartheid South Africa. First, let's hear a scene from the film Invictus, starring Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela and Matt Damon as Francois Pienaar. He was the captain of the Afrikaners national rugby team back in 1995.
Tell me, Francois, what is your philosophy on leadership? How do you inspire your team to do their best?
By example. I've always thought to lead by example, sir.
Well, that is right. That is exactly right. But how to get them to be better than they think they can be? That is very difficult, I find. Inspiration, perhaps. How do we inspire ourselves to greatness when nothing less will do?
To read your version, the movie got it mostly right, that Mandela very clearly saw that the Springboks team could make that much of a difference, but sports is intertwined throughout the South Africa story, from international boycotts to Robben Island. It was fascinating to read that, Roger.
It is a remarkable tale about perhaps the greatest revolutionary, peaceful revolutionary of the 20th century. To be able to recognize sport as the lever to bring the Afrikaners into Mandela's concept of a full multiracial democracy. I mean, it's brilliant. And to pull it off with such aplomb now as he is suffering towards the end of his life, it's a good time to think back at what this man accomplished, and sports helped him do it. The pictures, people may not appreciate how remarkable it is to see Mandela wearing the green uniforms of the Springboks. That's something even more extreme than having the mayor of New York wear a Red Sox uniform.
South Africa didn't enjoy the isolation by the rest of the world, of course, but the boycott on sports cut closest to the bone.
It did. Sports were very important for the South African people, or certainly for the ruling minority white population. And the boycotts worked. They don't work immediately, but they do work. And the international sporting community basically said to South Africa, we will not play with you. And that hurt to the bone. There's lots of things that went into the dramatic change in South Africa, but that was certainly a very important part of it.
You wrote about how I didn't know about this. I know in the movie Invictus, they bring the players to Robben Island, where the leaders of the African National Congress were jailed for many, many years, a couple decades at least. You wrote about how the leaders of the ANC learned to lead the country by playing soccer there. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, they you develop all kinds of skills in prison. Not necessarily good skills, but on Robben Island, which is an island off the coast of Cape Town, where it's where you are literally in the middle of nowhere. The revolutionaries, the members of the ANC, the African National Congress, were able to develop their organizational skills by organizing soccer and soccer leagues, which they took very seriously, and in fact was also the way that they were slowly able to get the white Afrikaner guards to, if not agree with their goals, at least not physically abuse them during their awful stay at Robben Island. It's a really interesting story.
The one of the things that South Africa had going for it in 95, when the Springboks were able to finally compete on a national level and ended up winning the World Championship, right? I don't know what the...
Yes, it's the World Cup.
World Cup, that's right.
The World Cup.
You know, wow. I mean, wow. What a triumph on so many levels. But,
it's a remarkable film. It would be something that people would make up. In order to have a summer smash at the box office, but it's all true.
But one of the things that South Africa did have going for it was its investment in public sports stadiums. Those were
That's
all
true.
Ready to go. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about public financing of sports stadiums. It's been a big topic in Columbus, mainly because voters here, unlike almost everywhere else, refused to do it at the ballot box. Nationwide Arena was developed by private interests, including and everything around it as well. Now, it's since fallen into the control of the city for management, but but the voters wouldn't do it.
And Columbus is not alone in that regard. The voters of San Francisco voted four times against public financing of a new stadium, and then eventually the city council just did it on its own. and didn't go to the people. No one, on the other hand, has lost an election because they wanted to build a stadium in order to keep the team in town. It is much easier politically to come up with the money. And the money is typically found in all kinds of really interesting ways. I tried to detail a number of the ways, not just in tax abatements, but also in sales taxes, because you put it on sales taxes. You say, you're just dealing with people who are coming in from out of town. It's everyone coming down from Marion, Ohio, or something. That's going to pay this. That of course is not the case. The proponents say that that this public investment is going to result in more jobs. It certainly does involve construction jobs. On the other hand, most of these stadiums and arenas involve very few permanent jobs. They're seasonal jobs, and they're not necessarily well-paid jobs. No one has ever been able to make the case that it is economically a matter of good public policy to invest in these private enterprises. On the other hand, it seems clear to me it is good politics to do that, and politics trumps fiscal reality. Ask anyone in Cleveland when the Browns left town, or anyone in Baltimore when the Colts went to Indianapolis, whether they would have been willing to pay a little extra to keep the team there. They certainly would have.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Roger Abrams, We're talking about his new book. It's called Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. There's pretty much little I can't, well, I'm certainly no expert, but you left no stone unturned. How did you, on one hand, I wonder, how did you expand it to so many topics? And on the other hand, how did you keep it from being, you know, the size of an old world book encyclopedia?
Well, the second question is easily answered. academic presses, this was published by University Press of New England, says, sorry, it's going to be 200 pages. Put whatever you want in there, but we're not Simon and Schuster. We're not going to do that. So that held it down. Choosing the stories is a bit more difficult. There are stories that I didn't get a chance to tell. For example, the great story of ping pong diplomacy, how Nixon opened up China because two ping pong players, one from the People's Republic and one from the U.S., got to be friends in a tournament in Japan. And the one from China said, hey, why don't you come on over? And the team went to China, and within months, Richard Nixon followed. The sports. So there are stories that I wasn't able to include. In general, what I tried to do in my books, and this is my sixth book on the business of sports and its relationship to law or economics or social history, and this one on politics, is pick areas that I want to learn about. That I didn't know very much about boxing, other than headline stories. And I really wanted to understand this sport, which was so important in the world in the 1930s and during the reign of Muhammad Ali. The Olympics is also an area that I had never written on, and so I knew I wanted to tell the twin stories of the Berlin Olympics and the U.S. boycott of the Moscow Games in 1980 as matching pairs. And so I tried to choose them that way. At the same time, using what I learned about political science so many years ago when I was in college, it gave me a chance to revisit Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and everything else that goes into politics.
I wanted to talk about the stories of boxing that you included in, or at least some of them. And we heard a clip from Muhammad Ali at the top of the hour explaining why he opposed the Vietnam War and why he was willing to give up his heavyweight title by refusing to fight. Let's listen to that again.
They are dying today to free somebody they don't know. So what in the hell is a heavyweight title and a few stinky dollar bills for my people's freedom?
I tell you, that was radical, radical, radical in those days.
Indeed it was. And during the 1960s, it was a difficult time in America for all kinds of reasons. The civil rights movement and the death of Dr. King and the death of the two Kennedy brothers and the war. And the war, this terrible war that divided our country and affected every young male. And then here was this fearless boxer who, as a matter of principle, I think religiously based, decided that he was going to give up the heavyweight title of the world in order to stand by his principle. It was an extraordinary inspiration to people of my generation.
And
on the other hand, people, there were others who hated him long before he did this, and who hated him long after he did this.
And another thing he gave up was the money.
Oh, my goodness.
He gave
up 3 years.
Right.
3 years of fights that were worth multi-million dollars for each fight. But the more that I read about Ali, the more I realized that his religious basis was absolutely sincere. And religion has always overcome money, you can, you know, what good is it to lose your soul and retain the heavyweight crown?
I wanted to talk about Joe Louis as well. You know, anyone who's seen the statue at Joe Louis Arena in Detroit knows that he made quite a mark. Again, much of his story takes place during the Depression and before and leading up to World War II. He ended up, well, impoverished in the end. He did not end up wealthy, unlike his opponent, you know, his most famous opponent from Germany.
Yes, Max Schmeling. And but those two battles in 1936 and 2 years later, almost exactly two years later, in 1938, both in Yankee Stadium. So it was the sports venue of the country, really symbolized a world about to explode in war. Here was the son of a sharecropper. And for a lot of people in the United States, supporting a black athlete was certainly not something that they were inclined to do. But he was boxing the embodiment of evil, even if Max Schmeling was not an avowed Nazi, and he was not. He certainly enjoyed the support of Hitler and his cronies, who loved to call him our Maxi. But those epic battles really represented good and evil. The German radio Telefunken broadcast the first fight live at 3 a.m. in Berlin, and everyone was ordered to listen to the fight. But in the second fight, which is, of course, the one that Schmeling lost, and Joe Louis won in the first round, when the bout was over, something happened to the radio transmission, and all of a sudden, no one in Germany was able to hear that their hero had died. Boxing was at the very top of the sports calendar. These were front page stories, and could you imagine the impact that this had on the black community throughout the United States, that their Joe Louis was champion of the world?
I think it said so much about him that he was defeated in the first one, and he picked himself up, dusted himself off, and just fought his way back to do it again.
And doing it again is a very important political act. We have seen that.
Wow, right. Nice
Richard
segue.
Right. And, well, doing my best.
Yeah.
but you can see how revenge, in order to establish your reputation, a matter of pride, was crucially important. And indeed, while at the end he may have ended up without funds, he lived a great life and is still remembered in the black community in the same way as Jesse Owens was, as beacons of light during a terrible time for African Americans in America.
My guest, Roger Abrams, we're talking about his new book, Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. Roger's written several other books, as you mentioned. Sports Justice, The Law and Business, and the Business of Sports, Legal Bases, Baseball and the Law, and the First World Series, and the Baseball Fanatics of 1903, among others. If you have a question or comment for Roger, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Wexner Heritage Village, home of geriatric planning solutions. Now there's a GPS for families navigating the complex and changing landscape of senior health care. More on Wexner Heritage Village's geriatric planning solutions at whv.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how being African in America compares with being African-American. We talk with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie about her new semi-autobiographical novel, Americana. Growing up in Nigeria, she wasn't defined by her race. When she came to America to attend college, she found herself in the middle of racial conflicts she didn't even understand. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from OSU's Department of Neurology conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can limit the effects of a traumatic brain injury or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey, and how to opt out of the study are at protectiii.com.
You're mobile, and we are too. Now you can get 89.7 NPR News anytime, anywhere with the free WOSU Public Media mobile app. It features live audio streaming, news stories on demand, and podcasts of your favorite shows. Just go to wosu.org/mobile app and download the app today.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the intersection of sports and politics through history with Roger Abrams, the author of a new book. It's called Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. Sports stars have long had the bully pulpit. Some use it quietly, others not at all. We talked earlier about Muhammad Ali. Recently, former Chicago Bull Dennis Rodman caused a stir and invited quite a bit of criticism when he visited North Korea with some of the Harlem Globetrotters and a documentary film crew. On The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, Rodman described his visit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
He respected me like that because we didn't talk about politics, but what he did say, though, he said, Dennis, this may create something that's very positive if you can only ask Obama to call me. That's what he told me to tell Obama.
Tell Obama to call him.
Call him.
Did you get the number? I'll call him right now.
yeah. You know, as I said earlier, a lot of people were highly critical of that visit with the Vice Magazine film crew, but many have since seen that Rodman played virtually no role in the documentary, but was key to getting access to North Korea for that crew. Where apparently they're crazy about basketball.
Well, I think you could have said, apparently they're crazy, and then put a period.
True.
Well, you know, I think it's very understandable that they would be crazy about basketball. Basketball is the second most popular sport in the world. Soccer is first, and cricket is third, but basketball, which was created in Springfield, Massachusetts, in order to occupy some students during the winter time in New England, has spread worldwide. Now, whether I would choose Dennis Rodman to be the representative of this great American schoolyard sport, well, that's beside the point. Mm-hmm. Apparently, he was coming, and the new leader of North Korea was absolutely thrilled. It, in the very least, it should be considered bizarre. But that's okay. Sports sometimes are bizarre. I try to tell stories in the book that that reflect some of the good aspects of sports, but you know, two countries in Central America have to compete. El Salvador and Honduras are competing for the last slot in the World Cup tournament. They have three matches against each other, and because of the riots that are created by these matches, they engage in a war where thousands of people are killed.
Now, this is in 1969.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
And that and referred to generally as the, quote, soccer war. And that's how the New York Times referred to it at the time. But it was serious war caused by sport. Now, that's even more bizarre than Dennis Rodman, I think.
That's taking a little bit too far.
I think it's taking a little too far, although there's always been this connection between war and sports. The in the Balkan states, Each one of the current countries have a favorite national soccer team, and this large group of cheering fans. Well, during the Balkan Wars, during the 1990s, those fans formed into paramilitary organizations and fought each other, not on the pitch, but in the fields and the forests of that country. And then when the war was over, they went back to rooting for soccer.
If you have a question.
It's a strange, some of it is very strange. Some of it is awful. Some of it is truly wonderful.
You write about women in sports, of course.
Yes.
You know, huge changes when Title IX went into effect.
You know, I have seen those changes in my classes. I teach sports law at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. But I first began teaching sports law when I was a faculty member at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. And I remember those early classes where I would have a large class filled with men and just a couple of women in the front. You know, I encouraged women to take the course because there were jobs available in the sports business, especially for women, where there were few women in the field. But you know, they weren't that interested. Now, at Northeastern, at least half of the students are women, and the first day of class, I ask the entire student group, how many played college sports? And all of their hands go up, and that's including the half that are women. That's Title IX at work. It has changed dramatically the role of women in sports. Not yet effectively in professional sports, mm-hmm. although the WNBA keeps hanging on, and we've started again with another soccer league. But that too will change as sports becomes not just a man's thing, but a men and women thing.
But as far as propelling women into places they weren't able to go before, politically,
yes.
it can't be diminished.
And it can't be diminished. I know that. If you look at Ohio State, I'm sure they have just as many opportunities participating in athletics for their women students as for their men students.
Mm-hmm.
Title IX is enforced nationwide and has changed the way certainly colleges and universities operate. With regard to providing those opportunities for the students.
Right. I mean, at Ohio State and the big-time sports colleges, universities like Ohio State and so forth, it's pretty much football and basketball that supports all these programs that they have to provide.
No, that is true. They
And that's
that
changed the nature.
that has changed the nature of the activity, and there is no requirement under federal law that any of the colleges or universities provide these athletic opportunities. It just, if they do so, they must do so equally.
Right.
With regard to men and women. And there are some schools that have actually abolished football. Northeastern has stopped mm-hmm. its football program because it simply wasn't drawing enough student interest. And it was draining the resources. One cannot imagine the Buckeyes without the football team. You can imagine Ohio State without Gordon Key, but you can't imagine it without the football team.
Well, let's talk about that. Ohio State, the scandal that ended with Coach Jim Tressel's firing at Ohio State is well known. His players broke the rules, and then Tressel lied about when and what he knew. But one of the side stories that raked in some of the worst outrage from, of all people, television sports analysts was the utterance of OSU President Gordon Gee. When asked if he considered firing Tressel, Gee said at the time, "No, are you kidding? Let me just be very clear. I'm just hopeful the coach doesn't dismiss me."
You know, I've known Gordon for a long time, and he's an extraordinary academic administrator, and that sounds just like a quip that he would have used 25 years ago. On the other hand, those people who are involved in academic administration know that he was closer to the truth than a lot of people would like to admit. Football was certainly king. But at great universities, Big Ten universities, academics plays a much stronger role within the university than even the best football team. But this is a perfect example of public financing of public entertainment. There's lots of people who show up for those Saturday games who have nothing at all to do with OSU.
The biggest fans I know, the biggest Buckeyes I know, never went there.
That's true. It throughout the country, you will find that, but it is specifically with regard to public universities, and so which involves, although a diminishing amount of public resources, it's still significant public resources. I don't understand how this all got connected to the colleges and universities. It seems to work. It's fine, I guess. But universities don't put on Broadway shows for the general public, and they don't put on guest appearances of other kinds of entertainment. But boy, do they put on football.
And it's political. I mean,
it
gives Ohio State and its counterparts across the country a lot of clout in the legislature, even.
It sure does. And my guess is those legislators seem to find their way to seats on the 50-yard line. But I don't know that. I don't know that. My guess is they do respond that when there's a phone call to the athletic director at Ohio State from someone involved in the state legislature, that call is answered without a question. But I don't think any of that is going to change. In the first instance, we're going to have to see changes in the NCAA and the way that it regulates college sports, or like I tell my class, the semi-professional college sports that are connected to our state university.
Well, is there anything more political than the issue of whether the players are paid?
Oh, my goodness. It is politics. But ultimately, it may be the courts that will decide some of these issues. There are pending cases that could break the NCAA wide open. Although, I really don't know how these are going to turn out. On the other hand, there will be football this fall, so stay tuned.
Penn State. In the year since the trial of former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, who was found guilty of multiple counts of child sex abuse, the scandal has played out in the courts, in the halls of the university, and on the floor of the legislature, and in an enduring debate about how it was handled and what it meant. It doesn't get any bigger than that either. That was Happy Valley.
It doesn't. And, yes, misnomer Happy Valley. It was a very, and probably still remains, a very unhappy place. But Penn State will survive. There are, in every field of activity, there are people who are, for one reason or another, miscreants, whether it's abusing teenage boys or are using epithets when you're a great Southern cook, the story now breaking in New England about the tight end who is alleged to have been involved in the murder of someone. That's going to happen. It commands our attention because these are public figures. or in the case of Hernandez and Penn State, they are sports figures. There's evilness around, but we notice it when it's people who we otherwise notice, and that too becomes part of this good and bad that is sports. I have written in an earlier book that sports really is a mirror of society, both good and bad, and that if we want to know who we are, we should just look at the sports that seem to command a significant part of our day.
And does it say something then as well that boxing isn't the top sport anymore? It isn't something that people, you know, you can get it on HBO pay-per-view, but it's not what it once was, therefore reflecting differently.
Well, maybe. There's plenty of blood. There are plenty of terrible accidents in NASCAR and other car racing.
Yeah.
I've never really gotten into NASCAR because I've never really enjoyed traffic.
Just the whole issue of the head injuries from football and hockey and so forth, we're really starting to pay attention to that stuff.
We are paying attention, but we still love the violence that is part of this, because that is part of what we are. The old story is I went to a boxing match and suddenly a hockey game broke out. if you go to the Columbus Hockey
Blue Jackets
teams, of course the Blue Jackets.
Yes.
Those Blue Jackets turn red on occasion, and that's when the crowd gets up and screams. I'm not sure we're particularly happy about people dying, but we certainly do like the physicality that's involved and the risk that's involved, especially when we're not participating but just spectating.
Which is mostly what you can say about most of us. Roger Abrams, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun. The book is, I've really enjoyed the book.
Good. And this has been my pleasure. Columbus is one of my favorite places. When I first began to serve as a labor arbitrator when I was in Cleveland at Case Western Reserve, and an appointment in Columbus was the height of my day, because I would go down and enjoy your lovely city and good restaurants and good places to stay and an easy return up to the city on the lake.
Well, thanks again, Roger Abrams. He's a law professor at Northeastern University and also the author of Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. Thanks to the All Sides staff this week, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Shannon Clary, Leticia Wiggins, and Emmanuel Jochi, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.